Welcome to Power Play and another day of intrigue south of the border where the president's attorney general faced senators for a heated grilling over Russian meddling in the election. Our bureau chief and a high-profile analyst are standing by to bring you up to date. Also on today's show, hate crimes are up slightly, but police report the number of targeted Muslims is rising at an alarming rate. We'll discuss if this is a trend that Canadians should be worried about. And a congressional commission is peeved with the Trudeau government for clearing the sale to Chinese interests of a military high-tech company with U.S. military contracts. We'll discuss the truth and the consequences with our press gallery. But first, it was the sessions that President Trump dreaded because it put his attorney general under the gun of a Senate committee with hard questions to ask. During his opening statement, Sessions did not mince words when it came to his feelings about accusations of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russian officials.
Let me state this clearly, colleagues. I have never met with or had any conversation with any Russians or any foreign officials concerning any type of interference with any campaign or election in the United States. Further, I have no knowledge of any such conversations by anyone connected to the Trump campaign. And the suggestion that I participated in any collusion, that I was aware of any collusion with the Russian government to hurt this country, which I have served with honor for 35 years, or to undermine the integrity of our democratic process, is an appalling and detestable lie.
Let's get the latest from CTV's Washington Bureau Chief Joy Malvin. Joy, he took the vow of silence on his conversations with Trump right off the bat. I'm still confused. Can he do that? And doesn't that shut down a lot of avenues for investigation?
Well, you know, you heard Senator Burr at the very end of this say, look, go back to the White House and ask them, because he said that he was not answering, and this gets very confusing, saying that although the president has not invoked executive privilege that these conversations be made public, he said the president hasn't asked for it yet, but he decided out of an abundance of caution that he couldn't answer the questions. At one point, Senator Wyden said, you're impeding this investigation. You know what? This tells us that Jeff Sessions is a loyal soldier to Donald Trump. It was really stunning to me when he said that he has never been briefed on Russian interference. He only knows about it from what he read in the newspaper, although he didn't dispute the fact that most intelligence agencies here have concluded that the Russians have tried to hack the presidential election. It was quite stunning. He was quite testy, quite furious, defending himself, calling any kind of indication that he colluded with the Russians, these meetings, that it was an appalling and detestable lie.
Yeah, I mean, he did come out very strong, and that's one of the clips he gave right off the bat, that he was definitive on there was nothing to this fake news stuff about implicating him. But I don't know about you, but as the day went on, he seemed to get a little hazier in his memory and a little less definitive in his statements. And I don't know, do you think he was rattled by the questions, or you would have thought he'd been pretty well prepared for them?
Well, I think he was well prepared, but he just wasn't prepared to share much more. I mean, I thought it was interesting. Senator Manchin asked him, do you know any of these people involved in the Trump campaign, like Paul Manafort, Carter Page, any of these other people who had association with the Russians? Was there any collusion? He just kept saying, I don't recall, I don't recall. And also very hazy recollection of this purported third meeting at the Mayflower Hotel. There were about a dozen to two dozen people at this reception. The ambassador, Sergei Kislyak, Russian ambassador, was there. He has been purported to be a Kremlin spy, but he says he couldn't really remember if they did say anything to each other or not. Very hazy recollection on all of that. And certainly a lot of the senators were frustrated. But you know what they say about sequels after the Comey drama? They're never as good as the first one.
You're absolutely right about that. But tell us what he did say about the firing of FBI Director James Comey. He seemed in some instances to confirm key elements of Comey's testimony, such as, you know, how the FBI had requested not to be left alone with Donald Trump and other things like that. So Do you think he helped Comey look more credible, or how do you think that fell out?
I thought, yeah, he did back James Comey's testimony about Comey feeling uncomfortable with these private conversations he had with the president. But then he kind of said, well, you know, if he was so worried about being pressured by the president about something that he was unaware of, if he was so worried, why didn't he say something to the deputy attorney general, to, you know, someone lower down on, you know, at the FBI? Why didn't he say something? But he also gave a perplexing answer about when James Comey said that he felt the attorney general was lingering outside, knowing that this was kind of not the proper thing to do. To have the FBI director have a one-on-one meeting with the president without other people there. And he said, yeah, I was kind of the last person around, but I don't really remember why.
I've got to ask you the other sidebar story. It's a pretty big story if it happens, about the speculation that special counsel Robert Mueller was going to be fired before he gets too far into investigating Russian meddling in last year's election. Is Trump serious? I mean, Mueller seemed to think, or Sessions seemed to think Mueller was a pretty competent special counsel.
Yeah, look, I mean, this just has the same sound and ring to it before Donald Trump fired James Comey. Now, this man is called Chris Ruddy. He is a close confidant and friend of Donald Trump. And he told a news station last night that Trump was musing about firing Mueller. He's frustrated and he's angry about this cloud of this Russian scandal just clouding his administration and not being able to get anything done. So this musing next becomes questions to the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein, this morning. And he basically said, look, there's only one person who has the power to fire Mueller, and it's me. But we have seen conservative allies like Newt Gingrich a month ago praising Robert Mueller as a man of integrity to get to the bottom of this Russian collusion thing. And then suddenly, in the last day or so, saying, you know, he's not a great guy, this Mueller guy, because he's building up a legal dream team filled with Clinton aides and lawyers. So, you know, whether smoke...
That's fire. All right. Joy, thanks for joining us. We appreciate that. So under questioning, Attorney General Sessions refused, as we said earlier, to have any to comment on any conversation he'd had with Trump. He said he was citing Department of Justice policy. Here's what he had to say.
Mr. Comey said that there were matters with respect to the recusal that were problematic and he couldn't talk about them. What are they?
Why don't you tell me? There are none, Senator Wyden. There are none. I can tell you that for absolute certainty. This is a secret innuendo being leaked out there about me, and I don't appreciate it. And I've tried to give my best and truthful answers to any committee I've appeared before, and it's really people are suggesting through innuendo that I have been not honest about matters, and I've tried to be honest.
All right, let's get some big picture analysis of what this means to the Trump presidency. We'll ask a keen observer of this chaotic scene. Laura Brown is an associate professor with the Graduate School of Political Management at George Brown University. She joins me from Washington. You know, I gotta wonder, Laura, if his testimony today doesn't get tainted by alternative facts, is this guy in the clear, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that Jeff Sessions is in the clear. I think certainly he has created enough sort of ambiguity about his conversations with the president that there are going to be questions about whether or not he can assert executive privilege, meaning that the president could, and whether those could then further be kind of debated and adjudicated eventually if the president triumphs to kind of claim that those are his privileged conversations and they should not be shared.
So is this a preemptive step to try and protect himself if Trump does do executive privilege? Is that what's happening here?
Well, certainly, if you saw what the attorney general was saying, was that he was trying to keep a level of appropriateness and essentially a zone of privacy around what he was saying with the president so that the president could assert executive privilege should he choose at a later point in time. This obviously frustrated a number of Democratic senators, including actually Senator Angus King, who's an independent from Maine. All of them were trying to get and trying to understand how Sessions was saying, well, there's really about kind of a zone of appropriateness here. And I believe one of the senators came back and said, that's not a legal standard. Appropriateness doesn't really exist here.
Did you hear anything at all that sort of shook the tree a bit and some new facts came out? Or did you hear what you anticipated through this testimony?
Much of what I heard was anticipated. I think what we see is an attorney general attempting to kind of put out the fires and appeal to his former colleagues in the Senate and say, look, you know, this idea that there was any sort of collusion or contacts, all of those things were incidental. You know me, you've known me for decades. All of you here in the Senate should take my word that Russia is not, you know, a country that we worked with.
I'm curious about how to deal with this rumor and speculation that the special counsel Mueller is, who's investigating the Russian connection, could be fired. That seems so far-fetched, but then again, the person doing the talking is fairly close to Donald Trump. What's your read on that? Could that actually happen without Trump suffering a rather precipitous meltdown in his credibility?
Well, I think what that's about is you saw Christopher Ruddy attempting to convince the president of his opinion through the media. I think what we know about President Trump is he doesn't really listen to his advisors in private, and he tends to take a lot of what is said on television very seriously. And so I do think that Christopher Ruddy was trying to create something of a firestorm and get the president's attention around the notion that this wasn't going to be a good idea.
Wow. It's kind of a sad way to get a president's attention, but there you go. All right, Laura, thanks for coming on. Laura Brown from George
Thank
Washington
you.
University. Appreciate it. All right, hate crimes against Muslims are way up in the latest statistics on violent and nonviolent acts of racism. We ask what they've observed as the numbers rise with our Muslim community spokesperson. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, Statistics Canada rolled out the numbers on hate crimes in Canada today, and despite a modest 5% rise in the total, the number of hate crimes aimed at Muslims is soaring. Public Safety Minister Ralph Goodale had this to say by way of reaction.
Clearly, this is the type of issue about which you cannot be blasé or casual. Statistics like these demonstrate the importance of working at this every day and developing the right kind of healthy, inclusive attitudes that will build the country and hold us together in a very constructive manner.
All right, let's get reaction from the Muslim community. Amira El-Gawabi is with the National Council of Canadian Muslims, joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Hi,
again. You surprised by the numbers? You've probably been sensing this coming for a long time.
Right. So at the National Council of Canadian Muslims, we actually document hate incidents and hate crimes targeting Canadian Muslims. And we have been seeing a steady and significant rise of targeted hate crimes. And we're not surprised by the numbers from 2015. There was a lot going on that year. Mm-hmm. We had the federal election campaign where Muslims were being talked about in a very negative way by certain political actors where, you know, the face fail was a central issue. I was on your show many times.
Yes, you were.
You know, too many times, I would say, talking about an issue that really most Canadians, you know, weren't that concerned with, mm-hmm. As well as Barbaric Cultural Practices Act was discussed, the constant sort of linking of the Muslim community and terrorism and concerns around that, where so you see that stigmatization stereotypes being portrayed. So that's why we had noticed ourselves, you know, almost immediately this significant rise. So, yes, we weren't surprised.
All right. So are the numbers the product of more vigilant reporting or an actual reflecting an actual rise in numbers?
Well, it's hard to know for sure. Mm-hmm. What we can probably see and say is that, yes, we are seeing that the incidents and hate crimes are going up. I mean, just, you know, unfortunately, it's become almost a regular conversation at our office where, you know, every couple of days someone is calling us and letting us know what's happened to them. But as well, we actually launched a national hate crimes awareness campaign with other communities calling on Canadians to make sure that they are reporting what's going on. Up to 2/3 of hate crimes are not reported in Canada, according to Statistics Canada. So that means that there are many people who don't feel that they should be reporting at all. And I think we need to send the message that they need to speak out and really assert their rights.
Okay, so we keep this in mind. This is two-year-old statistics. I'm curious if you're seeing, just anecdotally, an increase in hate crimes since Trump came in and since terrorist attacks have been hitting Europe. I mean, is there a correlation between that?
So it's hard to make a direct link, but certainly we are seeing the numbers going up. And alongside what you're saying, so whenever there is a negative political rhetoric or whenever there's a terrorist attack where unfortunately Muslims have been implicated, then you are going to see almost an immediate spike in anti-Muslim incidents and anti-Muslim hate crimes. So we're not surprised. And in fact, there was one study done even of online hate that found that between November 2015 to November 2016 in Canada, online hate against Muslims and other communities, sexist, homophobic, racist, had gone up by 600% in Canada. Wow. So certainly, unfortunately, what we're seeing down south has almost given license. And we're seeing a growth of right-wing extremist groups in this country, more rallies, for example, anti-Muslim rallies are happening, you know, on a frequent basis across the country. Mm-hmm. So I think really this reinforces that we really need to do more and need to see more from all levels of government.
I don't know how to explain it, but Thunder Bay is like so far above the other cities in terms of incidents per 100,000 residents. I'm curious, have you been getting any feedback from that city in particular? Is there a reason for that, or?
Well, it actually ties into your earlier question about reporting. We know that Thunder Bay had an education campaign about the importance of coming forward to report hate crimes several years ago. Mm-hmm. So that may be why the numbers are so high, and it's almost anti-intuitive, but you would say that, you know, when we're seeing the high numbers, at least people are coming forward. Right. But that, of course, is not the end of the story. We need to make sure that those issues are addressed. And what we have to also emphasize is that within Indigenous communities, there's a lot of concern around hate crimes and that people are not coming forward to report. And we believe that, you know, if more communities are reporting, mm-hmm. even numbers would be even that much higher.
Gotcha. Well, we don't want to give Thunder Bay a negative perception. It just might be they're actually very good at reporting. So, all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate you coming in.
Thank you, Don.
Coming up, our MPs share their political perspective on the rise in hate crimes and discuss moves in the House to deal with the growing backlog of unfilled officers of parliament positions. Please stay with us. Welcome back. The first trio of MPs for what could be the last full week of sittings before the Commons adjourns for the summer. They've gathered in the studio.
The suspense.
Getting
a little tear well up there.
Cabin's crazy here. All right. Marco Mendicino is a Liberal Parliamentary Secretary from Toronto. Karen Vecchio, a Conservative MP from Southwestern Ontario. Nathan Cullen, an NDP MP from Northern, beautiful British Columbia. Well, you're all beautiful areas in your own way.
But particularly BC. I
mean, now, you've got this thing going in the House now.
Yeah.
We discussed this briefly on the show yesterday. All these parliamentary officers of parliament just are not being filled. Like,
right.
There's literally five
languages didn't get filled.
So what's the progress? Are you getting this thing through, or is the PM going to say, no?
Well, it felt okay. I mean, okay, so we put the proposal forward. Well, first of all, we all know how important officers of parliament are. You've had them on the show many, many times. Canadians rely on them because they're a nonpartisan, fair voice on checking the power of government,
right.
spending and all the rest. So we saw with the latest language commissioner the problem that was evident. We wanted to fix it. So we have an opposition day today. We said, take the process as it is right now, clearly broken, move it to a process that allows everybody to have a say. The parliament still has the final say, hiring, firing, and that's how it works. The government came forward, the Chagger came forward and said, I have a problem with this part of it. So the Conservatives actually moved and helped us move an amendment. We amended our motion today to address the Liberal concern. And I just came out of the House of Commons and they've got another concern now and they're not going to vote for it.
Oh.
So yeah. That's kind of, it was feeling so good, Don. You know, like,
you feel the love and everything.
Parliament should do these things. These watchdogs are incredibly important. They have an appointment problem within the Liberals. we were trying to help them fix it and do it properly. And unfortunately, that didn't come
to
fruition.
You know, brothers in arms here with the Liberal. You're on side with this?
Absolutely on side with this. What we saw last week with Marion Mayer, it was really important that she did step down, and I applaud her for that. But this isn't going to be the first time. It definitely has been the last time. And as it moves forward, I think there does need to be more scrutinization and done by the opposition parties, whether it's as a committee or whether it's within those committees. I think it does need to be looked at because we have seen a lot of failure from this government so far.
Oh, that's kind of a baited way of getting to Margo here.
Don't take the bait, Margo.
All right. Margo, you've got the bait. Go for it.
Well, look, I mean, I think we always are looking for ways in which we can raise the bar on an open and merit-based appointments process. But the trouble with the nomination that was put forward by my colleague Nathan is that it essentially is redundant. There already is scrutinizing when it comes to officers of parliament. They go to committees. Those committees then make inquiries into the qualifications and the suitability.
Stop pounding the desk.
Oh, sorry. Sorry, I was just thinking.
The suitability of those appointments. Mm-hmm. And so this would just simply be adding another layer to it and replicating an exercise which is already occurring at the committee level.
Yeah.
So the trouble with that is obviously will create more delay and lead to some additional filibustering. And I know that what I hear in my community is that people want to see these positions and these vacancies filled. In fact, we hear that from the opposition. So I don't know how adding seconds. I don't know how adding seconds to the clock does that, but let me just say a last little word on this.
Very quickly.
The important thing to bear in mind is that when you look at the overall work that we have done on public appointments, the news is good. 70% of those appointments have been women.
Oh, stop it.
I know, it's hard for him to stay focused.
It's hard. I'm containing myself. But
70%
took
women.
A bad job.
And additional advances in racialized communities as well as indigenous communities.
I'll give you a quick rebuttal here.
Seven months ago, the Prime Minister got up and said, there's an appointments process, we have this huge backlog. 4 or 5 months later, the backlog had grown by 80% after he said we fixed it. So they haven't fixed the appointments. They've got some kind of performance anxiety issue going on where they just can't get to the place of actually naming the person, getting on with the job. Their first big appointment process, their first big one, they put in a partisan who, by her own admission, was too partisan to even apply to the Senate and said she was in a conflict of interest and couldn't investigate the Prime Minister. What do we do if these guys do the same thing on ethics or the elections
officer? All of that, I was just saying, adding another layer and more time isn't going to make
We tried to help you out.
It might be necessary.
I wanted to ask you, though, because we sound like we're in the silly season, just the four of us maybe up there on Parliament Hill. Karen, we got this problem coming down the pipe where there's going to be like 2 days of nonstop voting because your party wants all these. What the heck's going on? That's not efficient use of time, is
it? No, but we're looking at the estimates right now. And
you're at war, though, with these Liberals.
Let's be honest. It's using all the tools that we have in our toolbox right now to say you are not going to ram through these standing order changes that they've been saying that they're going to. And I am so proud of Candace Bergen and the work that she's done with Murray Rankin, the NDP.
You won't be so proud of her when you're an hour 30 of voting.
But you know something? We have to. Our job is to make sure that whether it's Parliament today or Parliament in the future, that huge changes like this can't be rammed through by the government. So we do have to stand strong on this, and we are united with the NDP on this, that we are standing strong
on
this.
You guys had merged.
I know. We've merged to work together to do parliament.
I think this is what they call a failure to communicate, that the government has said, we want to change the House of Commons this way. This is their second time, as you know, Don, doing this, trying to force it through parliament. Of course, opposition pushed back. When the Liberals were in opposition, and Prime Minister Harper tried to do something not quite like this, but similar, the very same tactic of many votes delaying over time, causing some pain back to the government, saying, work with us, figure out a way to negotiate these changes, because the rules apply to all of us as parliamentarians. Yeah. I don't know why the Liberals have such a hard time with sunny ways.
You've
and
been
hard
very
work.
Restrained today, Marco. I commend you. So would you like to respond to the concerns of your colleagues here?
Well, I think there's a consistent theme that has run through the first two subjects, and that is that the opposition want to create delay. And what Canadians want is for the government to address the business of Canadians. And there's more than a hint of some inside baseball going on here. Most people in my community, they're not really interested interested in filibustering. They're not interested in delay. What they are interested in is a well and proper functioning parliament. And that's what we try to work towards every day. And we do try to work with the opposition. There have been a number of opposition motions where the government has supported and lent its voice to initiatives which have been brought forward, whether it's in the Yazidis context or more recently when it's come to developing a sustainable economy by supporting an opposition motion when it came to the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So we are trying to be collaborative where we can, but delaying does not get the business that we have been put here to do get done.
Then maybe the standing orders don't have to be the priority right now.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe not.
I do want to bring a more serious conversation, though. This hate crime numbers, they're not terrifically high in total, but they certainly seem to be becoming more Muslim-focused. And I'm curious what you people are hearing in your writings and what you're getting from your constituents. Mark, I'll start with you. I mean, sure. Is this something you're picking up on the doorstep?
I am, and I'll tell you, in my own community, just last week, there was another incident of anti-Semitism at the Baycrest Hospital, just about 5 minutes away from where I live. Deeply troubled by it. I think we have to condemn any act of anti-Semitism, any act of discrimination or racism right across the board. And, you know, I'm mindful of the report that came out from Statistics Canada. I know that your last guest on the panel pointed out that there have been dramatic increases in discrimination against certain identifiable communities, like the Muslim community. The Jewish community is another community where we have seen very historically high levels of discrimination. And that's why motions like M103 are so important, where we all get behind eliminating all forms of discrimination. Canada is an inclusive, diverse country. As the Prime Minister often says, that's a strength and not a weakness, and we should all be proud to live here.
What are you hearing, Karen?
You know, unfortunately, I do hear the same thing, whether what religion it is, what color your skin may be, where you come from, the culture. Culture differences. The thing is, it's our job to be the leaders. I know I was at a dinner, a Ramadan dinner in London. Our job is to reach out and to build those bridges. And, you know, when it comes to humans, a human is a human is a human. But the bottom line is we have to do better and we need to make sure that we stay focused and unite. I know our party is working very hard with our outreach and that's what we need to continue to do. There's right, no Hayden. Place in Canada for this.
I mean,
this.
You're in a more remote place. This is mostly concentrated in big cities, but I'm sure your colleagues.
We have Muslim community up north as well. I guess it reminds me that words matter, right? And that when you see rhetoric, particularly coming out of Washington and some other places around the world, the rise of the quote-unquote alt-right or whatever that is, those words sometimes turn into actions. Some people feel more encouraged that they can yell at somebody on a bus for how they're dressed or who they happen to be. They're not going to find a lot of distinction between us. The communication, reaching out, having cultural communities talk to one another, but it's also condemning it when we see it on the world stage.
Right.
When we see policies, when we see statements from other world leaders that obviously infiltrate into our conversations here in Canada, it's also required of our leadership to stand up to it and speak out against it.
And just if I could, to put a finer point on it, this past week, my colleague Arnold Chan gave an address to the House where he talked about raising the level of civility in the House of Commons. I think this is an area where we can all agree that civility is so important, that being unified behind our joint effort to eliminate all forms of discrimination is an opportunity for us to live up to that high standard that he continues to set every day.
Do we see you guys next week, or are you gone off
to wait?
You want more silly season?
Maybe here. Well, we hope you're here. You're always fine. We love having you on the show. All right. Till next week, then.
Till next week.
If you're not finished voting by then, I'll understand. All right. Coming up, a high-tech firm producing satellite communications will be sold to Chinese buyers, even though the U.S. military is an unhappy customer. That triggered an uproar in the House today, with MPs demanding a security review. The press gallery is standing by to discuss this and more. Please stay with us. Welcome back. Well, there was a ruckus in the Commons today as the sale of Vancouver's Norsat International to a Chinese company triggered opposition accusations it was done without a national security review. The company has clients in U.S. military circles, and American congressional commissioners are not impressed with this sale. Here's the soundtrack from Question Period.
The Americans are the latest to sound the alarm bells over this takeover, Mr. Speaker. And just yesterday, before the National Security Committee of this parliament, when I asked the question directly to the acting director of CSIS, he made it clear, Mr. Speaker, that the decision around security due diligence was not made by CSIS, was not made by the security agency. It was made by the Liberal cabinet, Mr. Speaker.
Let me be absolutely clear. We never have and we never will compromise on national security. We will always advance our national interests. And more importantly, unlike the members opposite, we actually value the feedback, the advice that we get from our national security experts. Based on their advice, based on their feedback, we have proceeded, Mr. Speaker. We've been very clear about this process. This is a multi-step review process. We've done our homework, we've done our due diligence, and we will always make sure we follow the advice advice given to us by our national security experts.
All right, let's bring in the press gallery to discuss this and more. Tonda McCharles writes for the Toronto Star. Robert Fife is Ottawa bureau chief for the Globe and Mail, and he broke the story along with his colleague Stephen Chase. Good story. Trudeau was very emphatic in the House today. He said, we'd check off all the security boxes. Well, everything was done. It's all copacetic. But this sounds like the opposition doesn't buy it.
They have said that this transaction was subjected to a national security review. It was not. All foreign takeovers of Canadian companies are analyzed or screened for security implications. If there's a if there's a concern there, they go to a national security review, which is what the opposition parties say should have happened. Two former directors of the Canadian Security Intelligence Services, Richard Fadden and Ward Elcock, who are nonpartisan, they say that they would have recommended that this transaction go for a full national security review, if anything, to be abundantly cautious, because this technology is sold to NATO and as well as to quite a number of the military services of the U.S., of the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And the American U.S. congressional watchdog has raised serious concerns about this. They have even asked the Pentagon to review the purchases, their purchases from NORSAT because of the technology transfer to China. So it's a very serious issue, and the government is not telling the truth in Parliament when they say that this has been subjected to a national security review. It has not.
Tonda, I mean, is this a big deal?
Well, it's hard to know. It sounds like a big deal. It sounds like that's important technology, if not important enough to the Canadian government. Certainly, it sounds like south of the border, they've raised concerns, and the Globe broke that story today. So what's difficult is it seems like the government is playing with some language in the comments and saying it's been assessed for security implications. We've taken advice from national security agencies. We have consulted with our allies, and we did our due diligence. And we're going ahead with it. But when you talk to the ministers, we did today, the language is too fuzzy. There is a two-step process under the Act, and the second step was not triggered, and they don't go there. They don't explain that reason. Why did it not go there?
So why are we doing this? Just to appease China, that we're willing to infuriate the Americans?
Well, that seems to be the case. I mean, China has said that as part of any free trade negotiations, we're in exploratory talks now, is that they don't like national security reviews, which they consider to be trade protectionism. There was the Trudeau government overruled the Conservative government, which took the advice of CSIS and rejected a Chinese takeover of a radar technology company in Montreal.
Right.
And that is a big concern. And then along comes this one, and they don't even subject it to a national security review. And this is kind of alarming the Americans, as well as we had AnBank, which, by the way, this chief executive officer has just been detained in China, taking over a key sector of the BC health system. So these are real concerns. Now, I think, Don, if this takeover of NORSAT had been subjected to a national security review, I don't think there would have been any. How can you raise a concern? If it's gone to a national security review, we have to trust the officials that they've done that, and it's an okay sale.
The government is also, let's face it, though, very clearly trying to signal to China it's open for business. And we saw last week with the natural resources minister on his trade mission saying, we welcome Chinese investment in the oil sands. And, you know, we want more investment, and foreign investment has gone elsewhere out of the oil sands. And today when I asked the minister about that, you know, they stick to the letter of the law. Oh, well, we haven't actually changed the act. Well, are you just blowing smoke then? I mean, either you do or you don't welcome more Chinese investment in the oil sands. So hard to get a straight answer out of them. I guess they're hoping to, you know, curry favor for those talks.
Mm. You know, and they said that they consulted the Americans, but they would not say whether the Americans raised any objections.
That's right.
I've asked the White House, I've asked the Pentagon, I've asked the Treasury Department, which would deal with these kind of things. They haven't got back to me whether they raised any objections, but the U.S. Embassy here said, well, we checked with Washington and we can't say anything.
Oh, it'd be nice to have an ambassador here, but we'll get one eventually from the States. All right, some lighter fare. Since you guys don't remember the topics I gave you, I'll throw one that wasn't on the list just to bug you.
Yeah, thanks,
our colleague Glenn McGregor has done a little access request and found out there are a dozen prime minister's staff earning between $150,000 and $300,000, but no names are allowed. Is that a surprise to you, Tonda?
It's a lot of money.
Well,
that's a lot of money.
But I guess they're big brains there. And as he argues...
Like, that's up in, like, Chief Justice territory, for goodness sake.
He argues the Sunshine List in Ontario and other provinces have this, disclose the names, and people are earning over
$150,000. To find out the salary range.
Yeah,
no, they're not doing that. That's really bad. And I got to tell you, we even tried to find out, just give us the biographical information of people who have been appointed to the Immigration Refugee Board. You have to apply for under access to information. What?
This is supposed to be the open, transparent government.
Well,
I guess they don't even know their salaries. But $350,000.
Who's
got that?
Hi, Jerry Butts. How are you?
That's a lot of money. That's a lot of cash.
So we'll just agree that they should disclose, and they're getting paid a lot of money.
I mean, that's close to what the Prime Minister makes. The Prime Minister and the Chief Justice of Canada make the same. They're on par. That's pretty close. I mean, they're in the high 300s.
Well, just to prove you that Justin Trudeau may have issues with the reporters, but people around the world love him. A U.S. poll showed that Trudeau has got a much higher rating in the States than Trump, although half the people don't know him. And Peru's foreign minister wants him to serve as the mediator to overdo the crisis in Venezuela and save democracy. Holy cow. Justin Trudeau is a
Justin
man
Trudeau
of the
for
world.
The Nobel Peace Prize before he does anything.
I guess it's a bit... Oh, maybe it's not a joke. I mean, this is the foreign minister of Venezuela that says, we want this guy to mediate a solution in Venezuela.
Well, he has inserted himself to a certain extent into the political crisis in Venezuela in meeting with the opposition leader, the jailed opposition leader's wife here a couple of weeks ago. She was on the Hill with Erwin Kotler, a former justice minister, and made the rounds and went into the prime minister's office and, you know, was greeted, and that was posted all over her Twitter feed and in Venezuela, in the Venezuelan publications. So I suppose, you know, he's inserted himself somewhere in there. But to be honest, that poll, I saw that poll. That poll was like, what, 800 people? Come on.
Well,
it's like...
It's an indicator.
It's an indicator of what? That half the country doesn't know who Trudeau is, and big surprise there, and the other half like his socks.
I just brought it up. It seemed like a fun topic.
You know, Canada is a member of the Organization of American States, which Venezuela I belong to. And if you're looking for somebody who is... has an interest in Latin America but is not part of the process, maybe it makes a lot of sense to have somebody like Mr. Trudeau to go in and see if he can make a difference. And
he's got a lot on his plate these
days.
Yeah,
I don't know if
he'd jump at an opportunity like that.
Think so?
I think.
That might bolster the case for a seat on the Security Council.
Yep. Ooh, there's a thought. All right, thank you both. I'm not bringing up any more polls with you, Tom and Charles. And that's it for today's Political Power Play. Scott Laurie is standing by with the latest news headlines. Thanks for watching the broadcast or listening to our podcast. Here's how you can reach us with show reactions and ideas. And of course, we're back tomorrow with all the big news from Parliament Hill, across the country, around the world. Hope you can join us again at this time on CTV News Channel.